drug bill again.
The Minnesota Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, it's April 12, 2011, and may the record show that we do have a quorum. There were committee members that checked in early. You don't see them. They're off in conference committees around the building, but we'll call them in when we do consider a vote if that's necessary. We have a new agenda today, a more abbreviated agenda. We have three bills that were on the original agenda that we are not doing at this time. The Senate file 1143, the Ortman bill, that was a bill relating to state government and making technical changes to the data practices bill, we are not doing today. Second one is Senator Limmer's bill on jailer injuries and sheriff's report to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension report. That has been withdrawn. And Senate File 201, the DeCryf bill on careless driving resulting in death, gross misdemeanor penalty, and that has been withdrawn for the day. Now, I understand that there are some witnesses from regarding that particular bill that were here. Are they in the room today? My apologies. We tried to get notice out through every means we could in order to inform citizens, especially that might come over here. We will be taking that bill up later this year, but not today. But I do see you in the room, and my apologies to you for not being able to get to you as early as possible. But thanks for coming. We'll give you notice that when the bill comes up. Thank you so much. Members, we also have Senate File 1092. You may remember that Senator Hall had a bill. We refer to it as an omnibus drug bill that we met last week on. We were waiting for the fiscal note. We do have notes or a reference on that. But we will be, it's this dance with the other body in the other chamber that we have to accommodate from time to time, where we have to put the language that we're considering with Senator Hall's bill from last week onto their House file number. And so we're going to be doing that first, the functionality of putting it onto that, and then we will consider passing that bill of Senator Hall's we were waiting for a fiscal note reference anyway. So that's what I would like to move. Now, let me just ask one question. This is House File 57. I don't know the exact motion. But do we have the language? Senator Hall, are you the chief author of the Senate version of House File 57?
I am.
And what you want to do is move the substance of Senate File 1092 in the form of an amendment, the 57A1 amendment.
I so move.
I'm just asking you.
Okay, I do want to do that.
You want to do that. All right. All right. Senator Backus, could you describe, or Mr. Backus, could you describe the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. The amendment is to House File 57, and it deletes everything in that file and inserts what essentially is the Senate or the committee language. That's the A1 amendment that's in your packets. Those provisions are basically what you agreed to last Thursday. And in addition, there are a few technical changes as well that have been built into that, mostly deleting suches and putting thes and things like that. So it's the committee language from last week with a few technical type changes.
Senator Hall, this is an author's amendment.
That's correct.
Any questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one, Senator Hall. And I didn't notice this last week, but I'm wondering if there's an issue with having an August 1st effective date when we're doing something like this, and that, you know, the concern would be that people would rush out and get a whole lot, and, you know, and I'm sure that could happen even if it was effective on enactment, but I'm just wondering if that, since it's August, you know, it's, and I understand there are retailers that probably sell the stuff that have already purchased it, not necessarily that we want them to sell it, but I'm just wondering if there's any issue with the effective date being August 1st on a bill of this magnitude.
Yes.
Before we get into that, Senator Goodwin, could we move this bill under the proper bill number?
Yeah.
And then we can get into the policy discussion.
Sure, because the effective dates are the same in both, correct?
I believe they are.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Senator Hall moves House File 57, or under consideration is House File 57. And Senator Hall moves to amend with the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. We now have House File 57. In the exact same words as the Senate file 1166. Were there any technical differences, Mr. Backus, in that language? Were they substantive or were they more just technical?
Mr. Chair, members, I would judge them to be basically technical. Would you like me to go through them?
Could you please?
Sure. First off, if you look on the A1 amendment on page 1, line 22, the original bill from last week or the amendment from last week had end either before the colon. In reviewing it, I thought that it read better without that, and there's the or on line 1.26 that I thought would make it clear that it was either clause 1 or clause 2. I won't tell you where they are, but there were a number of changes deleting or striking the use of the terms of the word such, and including replacing it with the. And then on page 6, on line 6.23, the word included was substituted for described. And upon further review, I thought that would be a broader term. I don't think the intent of the legislation was to I thought the intent of legislation was to include any substance, really, that was included in the definition of synthetic cannabinoid. And I was worried that the use of the term of the word described might not pick up, like, analogs and things like that I thought was the intent of the committee. Yeah. So those are the only changes to what the committee acted on last week.
All right. Thank you. Senator Hall, Senator Goodwin raised the question regarding the effective date. Did you have any response?
My only response, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, would be I think you've got a good idea. Maybe we could make this effective unless there's some reason that we shouldn't.
Well,
effective.
I might want to add on to that, Senator Hall. There may be some people that need some time to adjust to a new law, like get things off the shelves, destroy the product. Otherwise, if it's immediate, they could be subject to an immediate prosecution without due notice. And that's a question that this committee should discuss. August 1st, is that the only prescriptive date in your bill?
At this point.
Is that throughout the bill, the August 1st?
So.
It's separate.
Date?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. It's separate, that date in each section. So you could effectively change one without having to change them all. I mean, it's just a thought, and I'm not offering an amendment or anything, but it's just a thought that there may be some issues with the later effective date on the ban and perhaps even on Section 2. But if you wanted to do that later, if you wanted to think about that later, you could certainly do that just to point it out.
Well, this is a good policy discussion, but I think I may ask either Senator Harrington or Senator Ingebrigtsen, being former law enforcement personnel, if they had an opinion on the effective date. Right now, the effective date throughout this bill regarding these substances is August 1st. Senator Goodwin is raising the question that may cause some people to rush out and stock up, and others, if you had an immediate effective date, then there may not be enough notice to citizens that say, hey, get rid of the product. Any suggestions on your part?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lance?
As I understand the general practice, when we create new crimes or change criminal penalties, is August 1 has been the standard effective date. And unless there's a really extraordinary reason why that practice ought to be changed, I think it's appropriate to leave it at that.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's anybody from the retail folks here that would be concerned about that. I don't know. Is there going to be an abundance of it on hand? It's kind of like, I understand your concern, it's kind of like making non-lead bullets all of a sudden state law when you have just basically boxcars and boxcars of lead bullets out there. So, I don't have any concerns.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
I think leave it at August
1st. Sarah Hall.
In relate to that, if I were a retailer and I wanted to make some cash, I would probably order as much as I could right away and sell it because you know it's going to sell pretty quick. So to me, moving it up might be a good idea.
That's assuming.
But I don't think like a criminal, so.
That's assuming that they are following what we're doing.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's a reach.
Senator Goodwin, do you want to try an amendment or would you not?
Well, Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure where the committee would want to go on this.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, would this bill from here go right to the floor?
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
Okay. Then I would say on the sections, maybe council can help with this, but I would say it would be section 4, the ones that define the different chemicals, I would think would be the most important.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
Yes, I have a witness that thought he could possibly respond to Senator Goodwin's thought.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
I am Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And I'm not sure if this will have any bearing at all on this discussion. I just thought I would point out one fact. As I testified last week, the Board of Pharmacy has the authority to add substances to the schedules under rule. And I just wanted to point out that were the board to have done that, for example, with synthetic cannabinoids, as we tried to do, our rules become effective 5 days after they're published in the state register, 5 working days. So if we had actually done this last fall and hadn't had a request for a rules hearing, which delayed the process, the synthetic cannabinoids at least would have already been in Schedule 1, and that would have happened 5 days after we adopted the rule.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Goodwin?
I don't personally have a date right now, but I would say that it would be most important that the chemicals be banned immediately, not necessarily that the criminal punishments be handed out immediately, because I think that is something that has to have time for the public to get to understand that the law has passed that prohibits these things. I'm just concerned about the boy that died in Blaine, the 19-year-old, That's not all that far from where, it's not in my district, it's in, I believe, Senator Wolf's district. That's not all that far, and the eight folks that were sent to the hospital along with that death. And I am just concerned about the fact that the longer that chemical makeup is out there and being able to be sold, the longer that they have to stockpile it. But I also don't believe that the criminal penalties should be put into law until people have had a chance to understand that. So banning the product first would be the most important thing, and give them an opportunity to understand that the product is banned and has to come off the shelves. But I don't know what that date would be. I would suggest for that part of it, upon enactment, for the part of it that just bans the chemicals, for the penalties, I would suggest waiting until August 1st, as Senator Latz suggested.
Senator Goodwin, I'm going to ask counsel to give us some advice on this. Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, I guess there are three main issues in the bill. There's the bong water issue, there's the 2CE, 2CI issue, and then there's the synthetic cannabinoid issue. Some of these provisions are in the same section. So, for example, Section 4, which is the Schedule 1 section, that includes scheduling 2CE and 2CI, and also includes the synthetic cannabinoids. So if you were to make that section effective immediately and it would apply to the entire section, those criminal penalties for 2CE and 2CI would kick in then, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would it be possible then a council to say to have that divided out, or to either have that divided or to define that better under the effective date, to define which parts are effective August 1st and which parts are effective upon enactment?
Mr. Chair and council. I think you can do that. The thing is, though, my understanding is that By simply listing the synthetic cannabinoids as Schedule 1, there's not much substantive effect of that. The real effect is the provision criminalizing them. If you wanted to just make that one Schedule 1 change effective immediately, I guess you could do that. We could draft it that way.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin?
You know, maybe we should work on this later and perhaps take a look at it before it goes on the floor. And in the meantime, I don't want to hold things up for deciding language. So I appreciate your willingness to do that, and Senator Hall, too. But just a thought, and maybe we can work on it later.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin withdraws her amendment. Senator Britson, did you have anything more?
Yes, to that point, I guess I agree with Senator Goodwin on this. I think, how serious are we? Are we going to be, you know, if we're concerned enough about it right now, we're not really going to be serious until August. And I guess I have to question Senator Latz a little bit in that we do enact bills immediately. In fact, we're looking at one in my committee today with regards to the invasive species. I mean, we can't wait till August, it seems to me, to stop the spread. So we're going to be doing some sanctions that are effective immediately, actually before the fishing season. So I don't know that there's a standard, but it's kind of the default time you're talking about. Is that correct? August being the time?
Sir Latz?
Mr. Chairman, the civil laws have a standard effective date of July 1, but because of the unique constitutional nature of crimes and the potential for being put into jail as a result, a little more notice in the due process under the Constitution is typically given. So there's an August 1 effective date is typical for criminal new crimes, criminal sanctions. So, I mean, I understand there's some things which you don't need to even worry about that kind of notice at all. It's just you can get started right away on them, like the invasive species stuff. But when you're talking about giving notice to people to change their behavior, it's a little different animal.
Members, this committee or this bill will have to go into a conference committee as well. So I'm sure this will keep dogging this particular issue as it moves on. I wanted to bring your attention to the fiscal note. This is what we were waiting on last week. Senator Hall, could you or have Mr. Turner could explain the fiscal note
yep.
before us.
Mr. Chairman, members, with one exception, the provisions of House File 57 have been determined to have minimal fiscal impact on the criminal justice system. The exception was the addition of controlled substance analogs to Schedule 1. So the committee requested a fiscal note last week. We got it back from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission today. And for the record, I will read what they found. It is assumed that these substances will lose their appeal if made illegal. Therefore, it's also assumed that few individuals are likely to be sentenced. It is likely that if any offenders are prosecuted, many will be first-time offenders and could end up in diversion programs. The projected impact on state and local correctional resources is determined to be minimal. So House File 57 in total does not have any fiscal issues that will make it go to the department or the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I do, Mr. Chair, thank you. And maybe just one real quick point of discussion in talking with Senator Harrington, we still had a little bit of an issue with the amount. It would be Section 8, I believe, talking about carrying around a large amount and you still only be arrested and potentially convicted of a misdemeanor, whereas if you just sell one small amount, you'd be convicted of a gross misdemeanor. We still have some concerns about that, and I'm wondering because I haven't been here this terribly long, is there some kind of a report we can get back? I don't want to put together a lengthy ordeal, but just see how this does work out. Should we have to address this issue in next year or the following year if the officers are finding that carrying it around is going to be a safe haven, that we can address that issue if it becomes problematic right away? Is there some way we can get reported on this?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, the first question I might have is on any potential of a fiscal note that we may impact a department on. Mr. Turner, do you know if there would be an impact just off the top if we requested a report?
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Turner.
I would imagine this would be a pretty informal reporting procedure you'd be asking. It wouldn't be a $5,000 or $6,000 formal report. It would depend on what was asked of the courts.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen, the other thing, we can always get information from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission or from the courts to determine if there's a preponderance of whether or not this drug activity on these particular drugs are spiking anything as far as large quantity amounts. And we can always write a bill later without a report as well.
Yeah.
So that might be another way to address it as well in time. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of want to put it on the table. And you're right. The County Attorneys Association would probably be the one that would be bringing it forth that they're running into problems out there with
sure.
convictions and things like that. I just wanted to put it on record that we may have to visit it later. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Hall renews his motion that House File 57 be recommended to pass and go to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Next bill. Next bill is Senate File 593. That's my bill. And Senator Hall, could you come here and run the show while I'm presenting?
What are you doing in the face of speechless?
Hard on
something.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 593 regards prostitution penalties in the state of Minnesota. The bill amends the crimes of general prostitution and prostitution in a public place by separating and creating new subdivisions to distinguish and track prosecution of crimes by patrons and prostitutes. The bill does not change or add any penalties. It's more definitional, and references that are requested by a number of organizations that are following human trafficking issues in the state of Minnesota. Today I have Melissa Reed from the City of Minneapolis to speak on behalf of the bill.
Great. Welcome, Ms. Reed, if you'd identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa Reed, and I am here on behalf of the City of Minneapolis, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the Family Partnership, who has been a good partner in supporting this legislation. And I think that Senator Limmer gave you a really good explanation about what we're trying to do here. Current Minnesota prostitution law, the way that this statute is structured, both patrons and prostitutes are charged under the same subdivision of law. So what that means then for local law enforcement and for the state, when the state is trying to do reports and identify patterns of crime, that both of those crimes, a patron and a prostitute, since they're charged the same, that all the numbers are bunched together. And it's very difficult for local law enforcement and for the state to identify where the crime, what type of crime is actually happening. Is it a patron? Is it a prostitute? Because they're charged under the same subdivision of law. So what we're proposing today is, as Senator Limmer said, to not increase crimes or increase penalties or anything like that, but simply to disentangle those subdivisions, separate them out, so patrons and prostitutes would be charged under separate and distinct subdivisions of law. This would be helpful for us in local law enforcement, give us a better idea about what type of crime is actually happening, which one's increasing, which one's decreasing, whether it's patron or prostitute. And then also on the state level, the state is required to report to the federal government every year separate and distinct crimes, the number of human traffickers, the number of patrons, and the number of prostitutes. Legislation that this body passed in 2009 helped us accomplished number one, which is to report differentiated statistics for human traffickers, and this legislation will help us comply with those last 2 points and allow us to report differentiated statistics for patrons and prostitutes. So with that, I will stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Members, any questions for either one of these two? Yes, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Reed, I just had a couple, maybe they're technical questions. In Section 4, there's some very specific language around the age. And my question was, why wouldn't we want this to apply to anyone? It talks about hiring, offering to hire, or agrees to hire an individual 18 years of older. Wouldn't we want this to apply to someone who offers to hire or hire someone of what, of any age? So I was confused as to why we said only adult prostitutes would fit under this category and not all women who are trafficked.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Reed.
Harrington, the trafficking or prostitution of minors is handled under a separate section of law, and that's actually a felony. And there are other pieces of legislation moving this year that are looking at that. But this is for existing law. This section only covers adult offenders.
Thank you.
Mr. Backus, do you want to add to that? Okay. Any other member questions? Okay. Hearing none.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Oh,
before
I'm
we
sorry.
Vote, I just want to comment that the chair kept all the non-controversial bills for himself and gave the rest out.
Oh, I object, Mr. Chair.
But I'll support his bill nonetheless.
Make this controversial?
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak on this bill? Okay.
I do have one other question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reed, my other question speaks to this whole issue of what looks to be like a possibility of aggregating. This is in subsection 7, where it talks about within 2 years of a previous prostitution conviction. Is there a tracking mechanism for that that allows us to track, for example, someone that got picked up in Ramsey County and then Hennepin County and another county? Is there a mechanism where that typically would be easily tracked?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harrington, yes. This is existing law right now that a second violation is enhanced to a gross misdemeanor. So right now that system is working. We're able to identify if someone has a prior conviction.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Limmer, do you want to move your file then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate file number 593 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Yes. Okay. Senator Limmer moves it be passed, move to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Limmer.
Senator Newman is... I'm getting someone pointing to the wall, but I think that means they're looking for Senator Newman to present his bill shortly.
Okay.
So we'll just wait for Senator Newman to come in. Welcome to the committee, Senator Newman, Senate File 301.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 301 is a bill that originated as a result of an incident that occurred back in my home county. In outstate Minnesota, we often utilize reserve officers. We call out in the country, we call them posse members, but they are really reserve members. And in this instance, there were some members that were being used for traffic control at an event. And there was an individual who operated a motor vehicle in a somewhat careless or even intentional manner, where he endangered the posse member that was mounted and ultimately wound up striking another mounted posse member's horse with their vehicle. The county attorney reviewed the potential charges arising out of that incident and came to the conclusion that under the current statute, statute that applies to police horses did not apply in this instance because It was not, the horse was not being ridden by a licensed police officer. These are, again, reserve officers. So I had agreed to bring this bill forward after I had been contacted by a number of auxiliary organizations that utilize these reserve officers. Those reserve organizations include the McLeod County Sheriff's Mounted Posse, the Carver County Mounted Posse, the Dakota County Mounted Patrol, the Civil Air Patrol, the Three Rivers Park District Riders, and the Steele County Mounted Posse are all members of an ad hoc committee that got together with the idea of coming forward with this bill. I would indicate, members, that I have requested a fiscal note, and there is no fiscal impact in this matter. And finally, before I allow the testifier, Mr. Levinson, to testify and outline this bill to you in more detail, I would like to offer the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newman. The A1 amendment is an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, I am offering the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment reflects the identical language that was adopted in the House. This bill, I believe, is on the House floor at this time, or had been moved to the House floor. And I've reviewed the language from the House, and it did make some changes that mostly in the area of the definition of reserve officers, which is already defined in statute. And that is the reason I had offered the A1 amendment. With that, members, I would introduce to you Mr. Levinson, who will outline this bill in more detail.
Mr. Levinson, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Levinson. I'm a member of the Carver County Mounted Sheriff's Posse, and I'm pleased to be here in support of Senate File 301 as amended. Thank you, Senator Newman, for the opportunity to testify today. Senator Newman has identified the incident that triggered the reason why the ad hoc committee got together, namely that we had all understood from our respective sheriff's organizations and other law enforcement authorities with whom we work that once we are on duty in uniform performing on behalf of law enforcement, that we are entitled to the same respect and protections that other officers were who were also at their direction. Yet this incident proved that there was a gap in the statute and that some of the protections we thought we had, and in turn protections or flexibility in charging offenders that the county attorneys thought they had, were actually not existing. So that's the underlying reason for this clarifying bill. We are not paid officers. We are not licensed police officers, as the senator has suggested. We do not carry guns and actually don't want to. But what we do is we supplement resources available to law enforcement for a wide variety of tasks. And we do so in uniform and under the direction of law enforcement. We are all volunteers. We use our own horses when we're in mounted units. Sometimes we actually are asked to do things not on horseback. For example, my colleagues were involved in patrolling the levee in Carver over the last week or so looking for flooding exposures. But we did that not on horseback but on foot. But our members actually volunteered to do that. So we are volunteers. We act officially for the sheriff's office when designated. We and our horses, and I might note that we are cleared for service with the sheriff's office for a particular horse. We don't have a pool of horses available to us, as you might think from the county, the city police mounted patrols. We just have our own horses. And we will perform whatever duties are asked of us by law enforcement. So that could include search and rescue, security patrol. For example, I was involved with providing security for President Bush's speech in Chanhassen in the 2004 election. We do windstock patrol, county fair patrol, things like that. And the incident that triggered this was actually at one of the county fairs that we normally have activities at. We would very much appreciate having the flexibility for commonality or consistency in the approach that other law enforcement has when they are on duty. And the definition of a reserve officer that's in the statute in the proposed bill is broad enough to cover volunteers who are similarly situated, so that we don't have an issue of some being singled out or being seen as more protectable, if you will, than others. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has about the bill or activities.
Any questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions. I just have a comment. I want to thank Senator Newman for bringing this forward. In my previous life, I worked with the 30, anywhere between a 35 and 40-unit sheriff's posse under my direction, and the amount of hours and the amount of dedication is unending with those folks. And the committee needs to know that they're wearing the same uniform that the licensed officers are wearing. And I come from a ways back, maybe. I know it's hard to believe, but I've got some years on me. When we our mounted and unmounted traffic officers wearing the uniform actually did carry guns. So I go ways back. In fact, if I'm going to have somebody out there in uniform, I felt at that time, and the sheriffs before me did, that they're representing our profession, and they should be at least be able to protect themselves. Of course, that went away, obviously, with the training and the licensing, and I certainly understand all that. But the point I'm making is they're out there representing the full-timers most of the time by volunteering, and they should be protected under the same statute. So thanks again, Senator Newman, for bringing this forward.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I too volunteered for about 19 years with a chaplaincy program for police departments, and wonder, is this just?
You didn't carry a gun, did you?
No, they wouldn't give me a gun.
Senator Hall isn't. Senator Hall
fire
isn't that old.
Truck.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And but I just want to make clear, this is for police reserve officers, and they're not for in general volunteers.
That's.
Senator Newman?
Senator Hall, that is correct.
Okay.
And in a little bit more explanation in terms of the ability of the public to identify these reserve officers, the uniform that Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned is absolutely correct. They are in uniform, and I can tell you that the folks that live out in rural Minnesota, they're very, very used to seeing posse members. And the uniform that they are wearing is, for all intents and purposes, identical to a licensed deputy sheriff. And really, the only way you can tell the difference is, number one, they're not carrying a gun. And number two, there's a shoulder patch that clearly identifies them as posse members. Other than that, the public really perceives these individuals to be part of the sheriff's department.
Further discussion? Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, two questions, and one, I absolutely support your bill. Having had horses from all over the state show up in St. Paul to help with the RNC, Grand Ole Days, every major festival in St. Paul, horses are used as part of our crowd control mechanism, because we know that a few horses walking down the middle of Grand Avenue clears the street with no one getting injured in one quarter of the time that it would take a squad of cops walking down the street, and we'd have far more injuries and far more confrontation. So I absolutely agree with this. And having seen the horses, especially the Washington County Posse, help out after the tornado up in Hugo, I've watched them walk through the debris fields doing search and rescue or helping out there. So I'm absolutely committed to the idea of this. The one question I did have was just in terms of the penalties, and not so much the penalties in regards to the posses, but just the penalties in general. Recall Senator Hall's bill that increase the penalties for police service dogs, and one of the pieces that was I thought was very compelling in that was the restitution piece that would allow for restitution if a police service dog was injured, especially in the case where it is a volunteer and it's their own personal horse that is being used. I'm wondering if we should not amend this in some ways, or if we might be amenable to looking at amending this so that restitution could be also included in your bill, and we could kind of balance those bills or create some parity between Senator Hall's bill on the police service dogs and this for police service horses, essentially, whether they're written by professionals or written by members of the posse, either way. But even more so for the posse, just because I know with ours, we've got insurance as a city. I'm not sure when my friends who ride in a posse, if their animal gets injured, especially by the deliberate act of another, how that gets compensated other than by their own insurance.
Mr. Levinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Harrington, on the last question first about what our responsibilities are when we are having our horses involved in these activities, is they are our responsibility in that if the at this point, if one of our horses was injured or struck, the physical damage or the veterinary bills would be responsibility of the individual owner. There might be a civil action against the actor, I suppose. Restitution was not contemplated in this bill, and actually I understand it's a good idea, but we were more concerned about matching the possible sanctions to be consistent with the other police officers and police horses. So we just hadn't thought about that.
Thank you.
Any
and
further questions,
Senator
Marty?
Chairman, if I might.
Pardon me, Senator Marty. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Harrington, the other piece here is what I'm trying to do is keep this matched up with the House bill in hopes that we can maybe avoid one more conference committee. But that is maybe something that you and I could talk about it in the future, because it's not a bad idea.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, and follow up on Senator Hall's question, I don't know if it makes a difference, but I at least think we should think it through, and that is reserve officer. I mean, you're guilty of a gross misdemeanor for assaulting a reserve officer. As long as they're engaged in the performance of official public duties and you reasonably know that they're a reserve officer engaged in their official duties. So I assume that, I mean, somebody riding on a horse and so on makes sense. It's just I was looking at the new definition of reserve officer. It includes reserve deputies, special deputies, mounted, under-mounted patrols, and all other employees or volunteers preserving reserve officer functions. In other words, reserve officer means any volunteer who's working for the agency as well, and I don't think that that's a problem. I'm just wondering because we are calling them an officer even if they are presumably and I don't know because I've never volunteered to be a reserve officer. I don't know what that means. Can I just go in off the street and become a volunteer for a reserve officer? I'm not doubting that they deserve the same protection as a reserve officer, but we are saying anybody who's volunteering or working in the office counts that way.
Mr. Levinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, the intention of carrying, I think, the all other employees or volunteers performing reserve officer function was meant to capture more differences in nomenclature that they might be called, because we've talked about posses, patrolled, mounted officers, mounted unit, reserve officers. The names for this collective group may vary from law enforcement to law enforcement or county to county. This does not contemplate having people walking off the street, however well-meaning they are, to help out, because they have to be under the direction and control of law enforcement. They have to be visible or apparent in their uniform or other markings that are granted to them by the law enforcement authority so that they are recognized with the office that they're attempting to help. There are other roles for volunteers in search and rescue and other things, but that would not be part of this, at least not wasn't intended by this particular statute change.
So, thank you. Senator Marty.
So, Mr. Chairman, in effect, I mean, I think I understood what you were saying. I understood that to be the case, that you're a volunteer under the authority of the agency, which is how we are defining who the assault issue covers and so on. But in effect, a person coming off the street with no training can be, if they're in effect wearing some sort of official uniform and so on, they are going to receive the same protection. In other words, reserve officer, you're saying, because they don't have peace officer training, regardless of what level of training or whatever, they're covered the same. In other words, the fact that they're working for the law enforcement agency whether it's a volunteer or a paid person, and they're in some sort of uniform that indicates that assaulting them is the same as assaulting anybody else in the agency, in effect. I'm not saying that I think that's a good thing to do. I'm just trying to clarify that's what's happening.
Thank you, sir. Sir Hall.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that point, Senator Marty, because the way I read it, maybe we can get some legal response here. As I am a Burnsville sworn police chaplain in uniform, I would be covered by this.
Counsel?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, I mean, you would have to fall under the definition of reserve officer. So you'd be an individual whose services are utilized by a law enforcement agency to provide supplementary assistance at special events, traffic, work, crowd control, and administrative or clerical assistance, and shall include, you know, you can read the definition there. If you fall within that definition, then you'd be considered a reserve officer, and you'd be protected under Section 2. And under Section 1, if someone assaults you under those circumstances, there would be the heightened penalty.
Any other questions?
So, thank you. To that point, then under special duties, which are given to a police chaplain, would he or would he not be covered? I'm just trying to clarify, not trying to promote one or the other. Actually, I probably would promote police chaplains being covered, too. There was a police chaplain shot in his line of duty down in Florida about 10 years ago. So there are some things we're very careful about as we do ride-alongs and work with the officers.
Okay. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hall, if we go down to line 3.7, if you are performing reserve officer functions as a chaplain, and acting as a chaplain falls under those official functions, and I would think that the answer is yes, you would fall under the protections of this statute. That'd be my interpretation. But
okay. Any other questions? Hearing none. Senator Newman, move Senate file number 301 as amended. Oh, before we do that, is there anyone from the public that wishes to speak for or against? Got carried away with my work. Hearing none, Senator Newman renews Senate file number 301 as amended and be recommended to pass and move to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
The next bill is House File 460 regarding fire sprinkler installation and prohibition. Senator Newman, could I have, or Senator Hall? Senator Hall, you're moving in this direction. I'm not going to lose you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 460 regards the prohibition of fire sprinklers for construction. The bill precludes the state building code, state fire code, or a political subdivision from requiring the installation of fire sprinklers or components or automatic fire extinguishing equipment or other devices in new or existing single-family detached dwellings. It specifies that the provisions do not affect or limit requirements for any smoke detector, fire detector, or any other type of alarm component. It's a rather simple-to-read bill. It's only one paragraph, to read, but some people may think it has some sweeping changes. And I have some proponents of the bill with me today, and they can better explain the need for this type of legislation.
Okay. Welcome. If one of you, whichever one would like to start first, identify yourself and proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Senators, for seeing us today. My name is Todd Bierstead. I work for McDonald Remodeling in Inver Grove Heights. I'm currently serving as president of the Builders Association of Minnesota. But I'm not here today to talk as president of the Builders Association of Minnesota, but rather as a builder and a remodeler. I've been in the residential construction industry since 1987. I worked for custom home builders and remodelers, and I've had my own construction and land development businesses. I've sold hundreds of new homes and remodeling projects over the years. It's hard to guess how many thousands of people I've talked to about housing issues. And I've learned a few things about homeowners over the years that seem to hold absolutely true. The most important thing I've learned about selling homes is that people don't buy homes from people or businesses that don't care. People are smart. If a potential customer detects that I don't care how their home turns out, the discussion is very quickly over with. Yet, some have insinuated that home builders don't care about life safety issues because they oppose mandatory sprinklers in single-family homes. Nothing could be further from the truth. People buy their most expensive assets from licensed contractors who play by the rules because they know that we do care. We build safe homes. Our customers know it, and the data that Karen will share will prove it. But even if we didn't care, it's just not good business to build something that's unsafe. Let's just ask Toyota. The next important thing I've learned is that when it comes to choices in housing, that it really doesn't matter what I want. It only matters what the buyer wants. If I don't understand what people want in their new home and provide it for them, whether it means including or excluding something, I'll be out of business very quickly, especially in this market. Some have said that builders are opposed to sprinklers. Again, this is not true. I would be happy to install sprinklers for anyone who wants them, and I'd probably make a little money doing it. But in 24 years, I have never been asked to install fire sprinklers in a single-family residence, ever. In fact, I have never even been asked to price them out, ever, in 24 years. So this is not a builder issue. This is a homeowner issue, which is why it's so important that we're having this discussion here at the legislature. Homeowners are the ones who are going to be required to pay the bill, not the builders, and certainly not the members of some distant code committee. And all the homeowners that I've talked with recently and worked with recently about this topic, because it's come up now, have assured me that if they would have wanted sprinklers in their home, they would have demanded them a long time ago. Homeowners weigh the risks and the costs for everything in their homes, and this is no different. They will choose whether or not to include sprinklers in their new homes. Now, I'm not here today to marginalize the tragedy of a fire death. That's not my point. But I am here to convey to you that the purchaser, or what the purchasers of new homes have said to me for 24 years, and that is no mandatory sprinklers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bierstead. Another testifier?
Members of the committee. My name is Karen Lanier. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. And if you bear with me, I will try to make this work. And if it doesn't, we will just wing it. It's not my computer, so I apologize.
Excuse me. Before we get started, Senator Jungbauer, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Limmer, Mr. Bierstead. Statistically, do you have statistics? Because the statistics I've looked at actually in commercial buildings even is that if a sprinkler system goes off, especially through some small fire or other things, that the damage the sprinkler system causes is many times well in excess of the damage that the fire itself would have caused. And so, and members, I do have the 2007 fire code sitting on my desk, so I've been studying a lot of this over this issue and some of the other issues where they're trying to force in sprinklers. So is there any statistical data that actually would say that sprinkler systems in a residential home would save anything, except perhaps it may help in an occasional incident?
Mr. Bierstead.
I'm sorry. Perhaps we'll let Karen answer that question.
I see we may be getting to that. Thank you.
Okay.
And can we get a copy of this, or do we have a copy?
There is a copy of this in your It should have been in your packet.
Okay. Would you identify yourself?
Absolutely. My name is Karen Lanier. I work for the Builders Association of Minnesota, and I am the Director of Codes and Research. And if you want data, that's why I'm here. So I'd like to explain. Just a second. It's always good when you're smarter than the computer. So, okay, heads up. Thank you for that, for being patient with that. Just to clarify, the reason we're here is 18 other states have rejected the mandatory requirement for fire sprinklers in single-family homes. And they've done that either at the legislative level or at a code adoption level, because if the 2012 version of the international code is adopted, it'll be required. So just to clarify that. And there are questions why we're in front of you today rather than going through a code adoption process. And I think when once I run through the data, it'll be clear why this is a public policy issue that the legislature needs to respond to and not just a technical code question. So that's why we're in front of you today. Currently, if Todd or another one of our builders builds a single-family home, they're required to do a couple things. First, they have to provide a smoke alarm on all levels of the home and in every bedroom. And those have to be hardwired, meaning you're not dependent on a battery for them to work. So that requirement's been in code in Minnesota since 1980. Another really important change that happened in 2003 is that those smoke alarms are interconnected. And what that means is another word for it that's not so technical is they're daisy-chained. So anywhere any one of those smoke alarms picks up a fire, all of them go off immediately. So if you don't have interconnected smoke alarms in your houses, or you're one of the 4% of the houses that don't have a smoke alarm, or a lot of houses that don't replace their batteries as often as they should, think about a house where all the bedrooms are on the second floor of the home, and that's where the one smoke alarm that's working is. And think about a house that was built 2 years ago to this code standard. So there's a fire in the basement. And as soon as the smoke is picked up by the fire in the basement, all of the fire alarms go off. The smoke alarms go off in the new home. In the existing home, the smoke would have to build up and billow up all the way to the second floor before anyone knows there's a fire there if they're sleeping. So the new systems are incredibly safe, and I'll show the data on that. But I just wanted to clarify what exists currently. So if you look at that data, you think, okay, since 1980, we've had hardwired smoke detectors in homes. And the policy question is, has that reduced the fire death rate? And it absolutely has. And we asked the state fire marshal if we could have data that showed the fire deaths and what year of construction those homes were built, and it wasn't available. So what they did do is give us that file with all the addresses where the fire deaths occurred. And I correlated that data with county and city assessor's office data to find the year of construction for those homes. And we found 187 of them from the data we were provided from 1998 to 2010. And just so you know, I didn't find all of them. The ones I didn't find are on the back side of your handout. And the reason I didn't find them is because the addresses were not complete enough to actually find the data. So it's right there in front of you. If anyone has data that can complete this, that would be great. But anyway, of the 187, what you would expect is that given if the hardwired smoke detectors made a difference in those homes that were built with that level of protection, you'd see less deaths, right? Because they're not dependent on batteries. And indeed, that's exactly what you see. So if you look at the data, the last three bars are from 1980, 1990s, and 2000s. They're split into decades, except for pre-1890s. Everything's thrown into there within the really old housing. You'll notice a little blip in the 1930s. That's not because they're incredibly safe. It's because we had the Great Depression and we didn't build a lot of homes. So there's less homes on that housing stock. But in general, you can see the very dramatic drop in who died where in this period from 1998 to 2010. Now, if we focus in on the 2000s, there were two deaths during that time. One occurred after the hardwired interconnected requirement came into being and was built to that code. Unfortunately, that person died, and it was a case of careless smoking. And interestingly enough, if you go to the Fire Safe Cigarettes website, and the National Fire Protection Association is one of the coalition members, it says that if you fall asleep with a cigarette, on upholstered furniture or a mattress, you're likely to die from the carbon monoxide from that smoldering fire long before it ever turns into a fire that's going to trigger a smoke fire alarm. I'm sorry, a sprinkler, because the sprinkler heads are heat-based, okay? So the person that started the fire with careless smoking is going to die before that happens. Hopefully the fire-safe cigarette law that the legislature passed last year is going to help that and help reduce those deaths. But if in 2003 when the code was passed, we required fire sprinklers, and fire sprinklers wouldn't have saved the careless smoking death, we would have saved zero deaths in all of the homes we built. We don't know how many deaths we could have saved if the hardwired smoke detectors that were installed since the 1980s were interconnected, because obviously they work better and people hear and have more time to get out. So in that time from the 1980s to 2010, we built and housed over 1 million Minnesotans. Okay. So, I'm sorry, from 1990 to 2010, we housed over 1 million Minnesotans. We had 6 fire deaths in 6 different homes, and 3 were caused by careless smoking. So what I'm trying to say is if we have had 0 fire deaths in 2003 in homes with hardwired interconnected smoke detectors, whom are we saving when we add the next level of fire protection?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And trying to focus my question because I see the heads in the back of the room saying no, yes, no. And I don't know where that careless smoking death happened, but my son was a volunteer firefighter in East Bethel and got to pull out a careless smoking death in the city of East Bethel. And so I do know the specifics of that fire, that a sprinkler system in that house would have caused more damage than what the damage to the house itself was that the lady died in. There was minimal house damage, so if the head shaking in the back of the room wants to qualify some of that, I have more personal knowledge on that specific incident than others, so I see that. So I'm just saying that and putting it out there, because if you want to come up and contradict, then please have some specifics, because I get kind of serious and do a little too much homework on some of these issues, I guess, so.
Thank you, Senator. Why don't we get through the test fires here, and then we'll do questions, because then we can see what some of those responses might be. Okay, do you want to finish up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Just have a couple more points for you. 96% of homes, according to the NFPA, have a smoke alarm, at least one smoke alarm in them. 4% of the homes don't have any smoke alarm, working or not, battery or not. And 50% of the fire deaths occur in those 4% of the homes. 50%. In rural areas, 25% of homes do not have a working smoke alarm. So those people are at risk, obviously, that do not have a working smoke alarm in their home and certainly don't have the level of protection of a hardwired interconnected. If we require every person that builds a new home in a rural location to add a fire sprinkler system, the proponents of this bill are going to say, are going to say it only costs $1.61 a square foot to put in sprinkler systems, and that's the cost of a carpet upgrade. That's not true in rural areas. What you're asking is someone who lives in a 100-year-old home, my friend does, that wants to build a house, whose husband was recently laid off, so they're using their savings instead of saving for their home, wants to build a house on their land. And if their well does not supply the water supply, they're going to have to dig a new one. Whether or not they dig a well, they're going to have to put an expansion tank in. They may need to, and they may have to upgrade their pump. We're not talking about $5,000, which is a barrier to a lot of families. This is a deal breaker for people that are making, a livable wage to try to move into that house. So when you look at this data and you look at the one fire death since 2003, I would ask you from a public policy standpoint, if we pass this, what are we doing for the other 186 people that died? Because that decision would not have affected whether or not they died in a house fire.
Good.
That's the end of my testimony, and I'm open for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Limmer, do you have other test fires?
I'm sorry?
Do you have others that are going to testify?
Yes, I do. Could I ask Mark Brunner to come to the table,
okay.
Please. Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Chip Hallback to go first. He has an appointment,
okay.
And we'd like to respect his time.
He's not on there, okay.
And then followed by Mr. Brunner.
Okay.
Identify yourself.
Okay. Yeah, if you'd identify yourself, welcome.
Sure. Well, thank you. I'm Chip Hallback. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership. And the Housing Partnership is a nonprofit organization, works across the state. We represent developers and advocates of affordable housing in the public sector, nonprofit, and for-profit sectors. And then we support a network of affordable housing developers through pretty much every county of the state. And, of course, we are here in support of this legislation as a housing affordability issue. Minnesota has one of the faster rates of growth of unaffordability across the country. We've had 7 straight years where both for home ownership and rental housing, the number of families paying over half, the percentage of families paying over half their income for housing in the state has increased. It's now over 1 in 8 families in Minnesota have a severe affordability problem. We believe that the state does need to invest in the housing stock of its population, particularly the lower income population. We support the funding for Minnesota Housing, the state agency, and other avenues for bringing resources into what can be the gap between what people can afford and the cost of housing. But in doing so, we also realize we have a responsibility for looking for areas where costs can be reduced. In the existing housing stock and zoning codes and all of that affect zoning codes and the maintenance codes and all of that, and as well new laws which may help reduce the cost of housing. This bill, of course, only relates to single-family homes, but a good deal of the affordable housing, particularly in rural communities, is single-family. So we do believe that the bill has some impact and some cost-saving ability across Minnesota. And so our board debated this legislation at some length in February, and we did come out in support of it. And a number of our board members are developers of thousands of rental apartments, and they do understand, and the organization as a whole does support the sprinkler requirement for multifamily dwellings because of the proximity of all the people living together and in those units. But we came down on that the marginal increase or the incremental increase in safety versus the cost didn't make sense for new single-family homes. And for that reason, we support the proposed legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hallback. Other testifiers? If you'll introduce yourself and begin.
My name is Mark Bruner, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We have about 400 members and represent the builders of manufactured homes and modular homes. There are currently 8 plants in Minnesota that build either or both manufactured or modular homes. The plants are located in Red Lake Falls, Worthington, Redwood Falls, Montevideo, Detroit Lakes, Tracy, Marshall, and Verndale. In addition to the builders of the homes, we also represent the manufactured home communities in Minnesota. There are about 1,000 licensed manufactured home communities or manufactured home parks, and they are the largest source of the state's non-subsidized affordable housing in Minnesota for those 50,000 families that live in a manufactured home park. It's very critical that the housing remains affordable to them. They're also a large source of housing for the for local businesses and plants in those cities. Most of the manufactured home parks are located in greater Minnesota. one of the concerns that that we have with adopting, or if there were to be a fire sprinkler requirement in Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, where you know, we built in 2007 4,000 new manufactured homes in our plants, as well as additional 2,000 modular homes in the state. Those homes, probably 80% were located or sited in greater Minnesota, most of those on real estate with conventional mortgages. And as the previous testifier pointed out, in a lot of those cases, the well systems, the private wells that they have, simply aren't capable of producing the kind of pressure that would be needed to run a fire sprinkler system. So you'll have situations where you'll have to spend an additional several thousand dollars to upgrade the well, adding some pumps. So again, we have concern with just overall affordability and what happens to new home construction in the state of Minnesota. Our national association estimates that to add fire sprinklers to a new manufactured home, say a 1,200 square foot manufactured home, would run about $4,000. For a 2,400 square foot manufactured home, you'd add about $7,000 to the cost of the home. And in today's mortgage market, I mean, essentially, you're going to have to bring an additional $4,000, $7,000 to the table at closing. Now, it's not like it was 5-10 years ago where you could just simply roll in an additional cost into a mortgage. It would be financeable. So, you know, once again, we're going to be putting our homes at a, very serious disadvantage in terms of the ability for those who look at our homes as the only option for affordable housing in their ability to purchase a new home. One of the things that's keeping our plants rolling today, in spite of the tough housing market, is that half of the homes that we build today, and it's far fewer than the 6,000 we were building in 2007, is an export market. I mean, a couple of my plants in the state right now probably ship over 50% of what they build to Canada, just because of the demand in the Canadian market. The others, the homes they're building, are going to the Dakotas and states as far west as Montana and Wyoming. Those states do not have a fire sprinkler requirement. And if you were to impose a sprinkler requirement in Minnesota on all of our plants, what would happen is essentially you'd remove the efficiencies of building a home in a factory, because you'd be interjecting along the production line a different code requirement that again would add an additional cost to the construction of a home, which could put them at a competitive disadvantage for plants in other states that could build homes for the export market. So finally, I'd just like to conclude by saying that the adoption or passage of the bill would go a long ways in terms of removing uncertainty that exists with our plants in Minnesota. One of the things they'll ask me, and they have since the 2009 IRC standard was put in place, which does require sprinklers, is, you know, what's going to happen in Minnesota? They're very concerned about having to start putting sprinklers in the homes that they build, knowing what that effect will be on production. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brenner. Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kate Johansson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Association of Realtors, which represents over 18,000 real estate professionals throughout the state. I'm testifying today to express the association's support of House File 460. The previous testifiers have done an excellent job of articulating all the reasons to support House File 460. And in fact, they've done such a good job that they've covered all of the reasons why the realtors support this legislation. Out of respect for the committee's time, I won't repeat what you've already heard, but I'll be happy to stand for any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. We've got about 15 more minutes. We're going to ask for other testifiers. So thank you very much. Do we have other testifiers in opposition of the bill? Okay. If we can just get two at a time, that'd be great.
Thank you very much. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I'll make this as quickly as possible. My name is Russ Sanders. I'm the Central Regional Director of the National Fire Protection Association, NFPA. NFPA is an organization that's been around since 1896. We have 70,000 members in 120 countries throughout the world. Our sole mission is to promote fire and life safety. The U.S. fire problem is a significant problem. A fire occurs in this country every 82 seconds. We are losing 3,000 civilians every year to fire, nearly 17,000 civilian injuries. Many of these are horrific injuries. And it's not only civilians. We're also losing firefighters, approximately 100 every year. 62% of those firefighters that are dying in residential construction, and 92% of that number are dying in one- and two-family dwellings in this country today. 84% of the fire deaths in the country occur in the one- and two-family dwelling, in the home. Nearly $16 billion in direct property loss, and those at greatest risk are children under 5 and adults over 65. These are the groups of people who cannot get out in many cases, even if a smoke detector or a smoke alarm does work. A recent study in Australia by the Australian government showed that two-thirds of children from 5 to 15 years old do sleep through a smoke alarm. Two-thirds from 5 to 15. And we see similar numbers with elderly for many reasons, as additional medications, sleeping aids, and so forth. Our goal at NFPA is very simple. We want to make sure that decision makers like yourself have the facts when you make the decision. So what we've done is we've commissioned a number of third-party studies to address a number of the issues that we've talked about today. First is cost. It is, as a previous person testified, $1.61 a square foot on average to install a sprinkler system in new construction. The price does range from 38 cents a square foot to $3.66 a square foot, depending on the labor market and a lot of other factors. It is more expensive to put in a sprinkler system if you have to have a tank and pump, but it's not. It's on average. This in the range of $1,500 more, possibly $2,000 more. It's basically like a water. It's basically like a water heater in your that you have in your basement now with a pump. The pump does not have to be listed, which means that you can get the pump a lot. It's a lot less expensive. We also looked at. We talked about the adverse impact on development or construction. So we commissioned a study, worked with the University of Maryland and the Maryland State Fire Marshal's Office, and looked at four communities with very similar demographics. Montgomery County, Maryland, Prince George's County, Maryland, both have sprinkler ordinances, and they've both been in effect for many years. And we paired those with Fairfax County, Virginia, and Anne Arundel County, Maryland, also in the same Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Those two communities do not have sprinkler ordinances. We found absolutely no negative impact in the communities with sprinkler ordinances. There were just as many house starts in the counties with sprinkler ordinances as those without sprinkler ordinances. So there is no negative impact when you install sprinklers. Yes, ma'am?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ortman.
I'm sorry. With respect to the comment you just made, what about the cost of the house to those folks that are building the house? The cost goes up with the sprinkler ordinances, does it not?
Yes, the cost of the sprinkler is $1.61 a square foot. It doesn't necessarily mean the cost of the house goes up. I mean, you could trade that off and not have quite as high a grade of carpeting or not as an expensive countertop. So there is a cost to put the sprinkler system in, absolutely. $1.61 a square foot on average.
Well, I think you just said, sir, there was no impact in those communities with the sprinkler ordinances, and I would say the cost of building that home is an impact, and I don't think you should deny that impact.
No, what I said and what the study says is that there was no adverse impact on economic development or housing starts in the counties with ordinances compared to the counties without ordinances. So just as many home starts were going on in the counties with ordinances without.
Well, and my point is that the price of those homes is inflated with the additional requirements in those homes.
Well, as I said, it's $1.61 a square foot on average more if you put a sprinkler system in. That doesn't mean the bottom line of the house is inflated, because there's a lot of other areas where you can save more than $1.61. Upgrading carpet costs more than $1.61 in a new home, for example. So you basically make a decision, would you prefer upgrading your carpet or protecting your family when you have 3,000 people dying in a house fires every year? That's the decision that has to be made.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sanders, I hope you have some documentation to say that, because I can tell you that putting a tank in and a pump and everything for $1,500 in the state of Minnesota is total unadulterated bull. You can't even come close to putting the tank in by itself in Minnesota. I deal with tanks and pumps and things, and in the septic business, I've done tanks and pumps for commercial fire installation systems. It's horrendously expensive, so I'd like to see where you get your figures from, because there's no way you're going anywhere near that in the state of Minnesota.
Do you know what type of tanks we're talking about for sprinklers?
Yes, sir, I do. I said I've put it in. I installed the system. The last system that I did all the outside work, the pump and the tanks, was for a church, but we have priced it out for airplane hangars, small airplane hangars, for housing, and the cheapest members that I've ever found for a house sprinkler system that we costed out because people were interested in putting them in was over $8,000, and that was on a city sewer and water, so they didn't need the tank. So I would like to see the statistics, because the stuff that I've had real-world experience, and I do have 25 years of building and real estate background.
Okay. Mr. Sanders, you want to finish up on your testimony?
Sir, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
So also, we looked at Newport Partners, which is a research firm, looked at 20 U.S. communities with sprinklers and found absolutely no significant impact on water meters and water fees, which is something we hear a lot about, the additional cost for water meters and water fees in half of those communities. What I'm talking about today is not hypothetical. This is a research firm that's actually gone out and looked at communities where they have adopted the ordinances. Found that in 10 of those 20 communities, there was no additional cost. In the other 10, there was approximately $400 in additional cost, and that was a one-time, and that's a combination of the different it could be water meter fees, it could be an upgrade of a water meter, things of that nature. We also work with FM Global to look at the green aspect of sprinklers, because that's obviously an important issue. We found that the sprinklers reduce fire damage by up to 97%. It reduces water usage to fight a fire by upwards of 90%, and it also reduces the amount of water pollution released into the environment. They also, of course, reduce toxic airborne pollutants. That was another issue that came up earlier about the how much water is used in a sprinkler situation versus a non-sprinkler situation. I talked about Prince George's County earlier. I want to just quickly mention they were the first county in the United States to pass a sprinkler ordinance countywide. It's at their 15-year anniversary last year, the University of Maryland, the State Fire Marshal's Office in Maryland, went up and did a study. They found over that 15-year period, there were 13,494 house fires in Prince George's County, 101 fire deaths, 328 injuries, and there were no deaths in the sprinkler homes. All of those deaths occurred in the non-sprinkler homes in Prince George's County. We also looked at 16 communities. I say we, this is Newport Partners, looked at 16 communities, again, that have ordinances in place or laws in place. They found that there are a number of incentives that the homeowner can receive, on average $145 a year recurring. Builder incentives was right at $2,000 in a sprinklered home, and developer incentives was right at $1,271. Finally, the last study I'd like to mention was conducted by Exponent for the Fire Protection Research Foundation. They looked at water usage, and this is one of the issues that came up. They found that, on average, a home without sprinklers, it requires 12 times as much water to fight that fire in a home without sprinklers as one in a home with sprinklers. So you're going to use, on average, 12 times as much water in a non-sprinklered home as you do in a sprinklered home, and that's over a 10-minute period, which the system is designed, a 13D system is the system that's designed for one- and two-family dwelling. I'll just conclude by saying I was a firefighter for 29 years. I was chief of a major metropolitan department for 9 years. I've fought hundreds of fires. I've responded to hundreds of fire deaths. I've never in my entire life seen a fire where there would be less damage if a sprinkler head activated than without a sprinkler head activating. Never. I've never met a firefighter that would tell you that, a person who's actually been fighting fire. Fire, once it starts, only 23% of the fires, first off, kill 77% of the people. These are fires that are large enough. They go typically beyond the room of origin or beyond the point of origin, And that's how the people die. Those fires would have been put out, in 98% of the cases, those fires would have been put out with one sprinkler hit and nobody would have died. So I have no idea where that statistic came from, but I'd certainly like to see that. Thank you very much, sir. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders, and thank you for your not only testimony, for years of service. We have about 10 more minutes. Are there any testifiers that will not be able to come back at 5 o'clock? At this point, I'd like them to testify. If there's anybody here that has to, that are on my sheet, that have to testify and cannot come back. Seeing none, why don't you, except for you two that are right there. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and identify yourself, and again, we have to be out of here in 10 minutes.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tim Butler. I'm the City of St. Paul Fire Chief. I have 434 firefighters, a full-time department here in St. Paul. I appreciate the committee's attention to this important matter of residential sprinklers today and appreciate your time to talk with you. I'm here to speak out in opposition to House File 460 and similar legislation for three reasons. It takes away local jurisdictional control. It replaces a well-established rulemaking and code adoption process with a legislative mandate, and it jeopardizes the safety of citizens and firefighters. Mr. Sanders talked to you about national statistics about fires. Those are similar to what we have in Minnesota. 75% of structure fires in the state account for 75 structure fires account for 75% of the fires in the state. About 60% occur in family homes, one and two family homes, about $100 million worth of property damage. Those house fires account for 80% of the injuries to civilians, 95% of the fatalities, and a significant number of firefighter injuries. Residential fires have been the predominant persistent fire problem in the United States in the last 40 years. The problem isn't that builders are causing the fires or that they're building poor structures. In most cases and under most circumstances, houses are being built that are comfortable, affordable, and reasonably safe. The houses, however, become patently unsafe during a structure fire. The homes have to bear additional weight, sometimes 2 feet of snow on the roof in Minnesota here, additional weight of firefighters, firefighter equipment, fire water, all of those things when the structural members of the home are subjected to flame cause a couple things to happen. They're not able to withstand those additional stresses. New homes burn hotter, faster, and collapse more quickly than older houses, and they reach a condition called flashover earlier in a fire incident. Flashover is the sudden and simultaneous incineration of every combustible product in the home that event is reached in a fire when the room temperature is about 1,200 degrees. No one can live during a flashover, and even firefighters in their protective gear can live for about 2 seconds, and they can make it about 5 feet if there's a flashover in a fire. We recently had one, of course, in Minneapolis.
Excuse me, Senator Jungbauer, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair and testifiers, and with all due respect, if we don't need to hear glittering generalities about all housing stock, especially in St. Paul, you have older housing stock.
Yes, sir.
We need something that refutes this fact that houses have been getting safer in terms of fires. If they're not safer, then tell us that. And please, I've done this before, and it's not just you guys. In every committee I'm in, if you're going to use a lot of statistics, put them on our desks so we can see them. That's why I'm pulling up my computer so I can start seeing when you start talking some of this. Don't come in here and start, you know, babbling statistics off unless you got them in front of us so we can look at them so they make sense in relation to the legislation. And right now what I see is very convincing. New houses are very safe compared to old houses, and unless you can refute that, this is darn good legislation.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Senator.
Chief Butler, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll skip the statistics. We were asked a question, a direct question. What sprinkler systems and who would they have saved? I'll give you five examples that occurred in St. Paul in the last 3 years, no statistics involved. Specifically, mobility-challenged people, children, the elderly, and the people whose egress path were blocked by flames. In the last 3 years in St. Paul, we've had 5 fire fatalities in residential fires. 5 fires, 5 tragedies, 5 fatalities. 5 examples about how codes and smoke alarms are simply not enough to protect Minnesota families. The first of those fires involved a 2-year-old boy whose family was alerted by smoke alarms. They exited the building from the second-story windows. They left the 2-year-old child who was sleeping behind. Fire companies came from their station 8 blocks away. They arrived in 2 minutes. They could not save that individual. Infants cannot be saved by smoke alarms, building codes, and even quality home craftsmanship. They can't protect the sleeping infant. In the second case, an elderly man was killed, rapidly moving grease fire in his kitchen. 61-year-old could not escape the smoke and heat. The fire was on his body. He certainly knew there was a fire. No need for a smoke alarm there. Firefighters came from 2 blocks away, arrived in less than 2 minutes. Not able to save him, he died of his thermal burns and smoke inhalations. Again, smoke alarms, building codes, and quality home construction could not have saved that gentleman. However, an automatic fire sprinkler would have. 2 separate fatal fires in the last 3 years involved a fire burning between the occupant and the exit. First was a middle-aged husband, father, and head of an immigrant household family. The second was a 20-year-old college student living away from home for the first time. He died in a fast-moving, wind-driven fire where the fire blew in on top of him. His buddies upstairs heard the smoke alarms, also heard his screaming. They exited the building. We were 7 blocks away. We were there in 2 minutes. We could not save that young gentleman. His family suffered a tragedy. So did the university. So did the firefighters that responded to save this boy. Smoke alarms, building codes, and quality home craftsmanship did not and could not have saved those occupants, but that's exactly what an automatic fire sprinkler system is designed to do. Keep the fire away from the path of egress. Keep it controlled until firefighters can arrive. The last example I'll cite killed an elderly invalid, in fact, the sister of one of my retired firefighters. The woman was bedridden. She couldn't escape from her bedroom. Firefighters arrived in less than 3 minutes. She died of her thermal burns and smoke inhalation several days later. Alarms were sounding. She could not move. She was bedridden. Again, codes, smoke alarms, and even quality construction of the home could not have saved this lady. There's a picture in the lobby of our fire headquarters building here in St. Paul. The picture shows a St. Paul firefighter carrying a small child down a ladder and giving that child CPR. The firefighter's mask is off, sweat is running down his face. He's got the child cradled in one arm and one arm holding onto the ladder. His eyes are fixed, they're concentrated, they're focused on what he's doing. That firefighter photo circulated around the planet and captured in a moment's essence what we do as firefighters. That firefighter's name was Ed Reilicke, the brother of the elderly bedridden woman who died in that residential fire. Ed's picture was taken on the scene of a residential home fire in Summit Avenue in 1974. Ed won a national commendation, by the way, for that rescue. 1 year later, Ed was working at another residential fire. 12 people rescued by firefighters from that 3-story residential structure, no sprinklers. 3 people died in that fire. Ed Reilicke fell down a stairwell that was damaged by fire, broke his back, suffered a permanent disability, was forced to retire from the fire service. Automatic fire sprinkler systems not only offer protection to the building occupants, but help prevent firefighter injuries and deaths as well. They protect critical egress routes like doorways, hallways, stairways, and the hallways, kind of like what Ed Reilicke fell down. In the last year alone in St. Paul, I've seen over a dozen floors and stairwells burned out by fire. 2 of my firefighters fell through the floor on the east side. One of them was injured so severely he was off the job for several months. Far too often around the nation, we mourn the death of a firefighter who's fallen through the floor, fallen through the roof, fallen down a burned out stairwell of a private home unprotected by fire sprinkler systems. Smoke alarms, building codes, and even quality home craftsmanship can't protect a floor, a roof, a hallway, or a stairway that's ravaged by fire. But that's exactly what fire sprinkler systems are designed and can do. Builder associations around the country argue that homeowners have a choice They can have an automatic fire sprinkler installed if they want to. But homeowners who decline this opportunity when the house is first constructed condemn subsequent owners and renters of that property and the firefighters that respond for years later. All those fires that she shows on that graph there, all of those fires occurred when the all of those structures at some point were new construction. Within the established code adoption process, local jurisdictions ought to be allowed to enact ordinances that help ensure the public safety and the safety of first responders in spite of that individual homeowner's personal choice. Please don't allow the discussion about home fire sprinkler systems to digress into a debate about personal choice. The 2-year-old infant trapped upstairs in that duplex, the 20-year-old college student living alone in a rented house with 3 other people, the low-income immigrant family renting their first home in the United States, and my firefighter who fell through the floor were not there when the homeowner made the choice not to have a fire sprinkler system installed. Quite frankly, this committee must make that choice for these unknowing and defenseless victims, their families, and my firefighters that have to respond. The purpose of this committee, if the purpose of this committee, is to discuss, debate, and enact legislation designed to ensure the safety of the public and the safety of public safety responders, then I ask, with all possible respect to the authors and the co-authors, how the committee could support legislation that preemptively removes the ability of local governments to protect the safety of vulnerable citizens and the responders that have pledged their life to protect them. I respectfully urge you on behalf of all fire victims and their families and all of my firefighters and their families to oppose the proposed legislative moratorium on residential sprinkler systems. I ask you to allow the research, discussion, and debate on the home fire sprinkler system issue to be conducted within the established code making and code adoption process in the Department of Labor and Industry here in this state. Please oppose the bill and allow the code adoption to be a local government, not an individual choice, that's governed by the rulemaking code adoption process. And finally, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to with you today. I'm passionate, I'm nervous, but I wanted to share some of the tragic stories that I've seen about, to answer that question, who would those sprinkler systems would have saved? I commend you for your support of fire officers, peace officers, and EMS providers around the state. I'm ready to answer any questions you have, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chief Butler. I appreciate you and your service to the community. We are going to have to recess. We will recess now until 5 o'clock in this same room.